Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Crime Wire Investigates, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime, to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private eye and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on the top of the crime, at the top of their game. Crime Wire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. You can also join our live chat going on right now in the Blog Talk Radio area. If you are a friend or a family member and you'd like to send the Crime Wire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, if you'd like to be considered for a guest for a future show, our email address is thecrimewire@gmail.com. And now here's Delilah from Imagine Publicity, who's going to be giving us this week's missing person.
Hey, Susan. Thanks so much for letting me do this each week. It really means a lot to the people out there who have missing loved ones.
Why don't you talk about what happened last week with who we featured?
Yeah, we featured a woman from Naples, Florida that was missing for, I think it was about 30 days. And within 48 hours, I think it was, after we did the highlight on the show, she was found. I don't know if we can take credit for it, but it certainly didn't hurt anything. And, you know, hopefully we can make a difference out there. But this week, I want to highlight the case of Gina Bose. It's G-I-N-A-B-O-S. And if there was ever a case with a lot of missing puzzle pieces, this is it. And I've hunted and hunted online for information or clues in different places looking, you know, pertaining to this case, and there's just nothing out there. And from all accounts that I've read, Gina comes from a very musical family and is very close with her children and family. She seems to me to be kind of an artsy type person, always having the need to be creative, whether it's her music, crafting costumes, or art. And as a mother, an artist, a much-loved daughter and sister, it seems Gina Bose had a very full and very happy life. And I found no reports of any unhappy relationship with her ex-husband or any enemies at all. Gina is a 40-year-old mother of three children that she was raising as a single mother. And all that's known about the evening of October 17th, 2000, is that she gave a performance at Duggan's Pub in Lincoln, Nebraska. She was last seen with her guitar over her shoulder and walking out of the pub. The next morning, her car was discovered across the street from the pub with the trunk open and her guitar inside, which is something that's very uncharacteristic for her to do. There's no other clues, no evidence, nothing leading authorities to what happened to Gina that night. And her sister, Janelle Rapp, R-E-P, she belongs to a band called Clementine, and they regularly perform to bring awareness not only to Gina's case but other missing persons' cases. And they each year they do what's called the Squeaky Wheel Tour. And it's a very well-known and respected global outreach for families searching for missing loved ones. Her organization, 411 Gina, works to expose missing persons cases who otherwise wouldn't be known. So her name is actually Regina, R-E-G-I-N-A, Bose. She is also known as Gina Williams or Gina Rapp. And she went missing from Lincoln, Nebraska, October 17th, 2000, 40 years old, white female, 105 pounds, brown hair, brown eyes, medium complexion, and she wears wireframe glasses or contacts. She has a tattoo of small purple flower on her back. She has pierced ears and freckles. She was wearing a black shirt, pants, and shoes the night she went missing. And the website, again, is 411gina.org. And I really don't have a lot to update on Billy's Law other than we're still urging citizens to contact the Senate Judiciary Committee, ask for their support and co-sponsorship for the Help Find the Missing Act, which is Senate number 3019. And you can go to Peace for the Missing, which is kind of like Command Central for any information you might need or any updates. And the website is Peace for the number 4. missing.ning.com.
Delilah,
thank you
very much. Thank you.
Thanks
and,
so much.
And tonight we're going to be discussing the case of Sean McMillan. And on September 2nd, 2001, at 2:26 a.m., Sean McMillan was driven to the Helen Ellis Hospital in Tarpon Springs, Florida, by Rita Nordmark and her brother-in-law, Dan Nordmark, who was an off-duty corrections officer. A bullet from the officer's gun had ripped through Sean's brain. Officer Nordmark alleged the wound was self-inflicted. The facts indicate otherwise, however. But Sean was dead at the age of 26. According to Sean's mother, Michaela Mahoney, Sean was as far from suicidal that day as anyone could be. He had worked with her at her law office most of the day and was in good spirits. And I'm going to pause here for a few minutes. I want to say that Michaela is aware we're doing Sean's story tonight. For emotional reasons, she preferred not to to be on the show with us. I'm sure she's listening. And to join us on the line tonight to discuss the case is our good friend from Citizens Against Homicide, Gene Cervantes. Gene, thank you.
Thank you for allowing me on the show, and thank you, Michaela, for allowing me to represent your family.
And before I continue with the background, Gene, would you please just let the listeners know how you happened to become involved with this case?
Well, Michaela had called us here at Citizens Against Homicide several months ago, back in 2009, I believe, and asked if we could help. One of the unfortunate situations of our services at Citizens Against Homicide is that we deal exclusively with murder victims, and she had a COD as determined by the medical examiner, cause of death, as determined by the medical examiner to be suicide. It was ironic because I had hung on to several cases of suicide determination cases by the medical examiner only because there was every indication that foul play was involved. And I indicated that I'll hang on to this case, but, you know, we couldn't actively get involved because we would probably be dismissed in all likelihood by the medical examiner, the sheriff, any investigative agency. In this case, it was Tarpon Springs Police Department, would have dismissed us as, for reasons that, hey, this is a suicide and not a homicide. So the case is closed. So I just hung on to it, eventually made the rounds, got on one of your talk shows last year and or earlier this year, and lo and behold, we made contact on an unrelated case. And to my good fortune, Citizens Against Homicide has partnered up with CrimeWire, and we're happy to have that relationship.
And as are we, I think I'm speaking for Susan and Vito and the rest of our team here. Okay, let me go on and give some more background on that night and Sean's case. Michaela had dropped Sean off at the Ale House restaurant at 5:30 p.m. to meet some acquaintances. They proceeded from there to the British Pub to play pool. That's where they ran into Nordmark, another casual acquaintance of Sean's, who offered to give Sean a ride home. First, however, Nordmark and his best friend, Bernie Dillman, wanted to go to the Pounds Bar and Grill for karaoke. Sean accompanied them there and then back to the pub, still waiting to get his ride home. Michaela believes the police reports are riddled with lies and omissions that completely conceal the events of that fateful night. Nordmark and Dillman had a very good reason to conceal the truth. While at the Palms, the two allegedly inebriated men had become furious at Kimberly, the karaoke lady. The terrified woman gave a sworn statement that she feared for her life and Sean's life as well, because he tried to protect her from the belligerent men. They had followed her into the parking lot, yelling obscenities while she loaded her equipment. She and other witnesses described Nordmark and Dillman as violently angry and, quote, evil, unquote. 20 minutes after the confrontation with Kimberly, the trio was back at the British pub where they had gone after being evicted from the Palms. Dan Nordmark brought out his firearm and drunkenly waved it about in front of witnesses. He reportedly jammed the slide several times in his effort to load and cock it, and then handed the gun to Dillman, who fired it at an adjacent gas station and occupied mobile home park. The terrified bar patrons fled the premises in fear of being injured or killed. McCallis said the visit to the British pub, which is owned by the Nordmark family, the events that took place there and the identities of the witnesses to those events were withheld from police reports. The Nordmarks asserted that they had been at a different bar that night. Later, when caught and confronted with that story, they explained they were confused about the name of the bar due to all the excitement. Dan and Rita Nordmark originally stated that Sean was seated in the center of the back seat and was leaning forward between them, giving Rita directions to his home when he was shot in the head. While Sean lay dying in the emergency room at the hospital, a sergeant with the Tarpon Springs Police Department arrived. He began his official report with these words. At 2:39 hours on September 2, 2001, I was called at my residence in reference to responding to a shooting at Helen Ellis ER with special circumstances. McCalla believes the term special circumstances was the code used to tip off responding officers that a fellow member of law enforcement was involved. There's a lot more. I'm going to pause again for a minute to get into this with Gene. Gene, what's your experience been, if any, when there's a shooting involving a law enforcement officer? He was a corrections officer. I'm not sure what their powers are in the state of Florida, but have you ever encountered, or do you think McCalla is on here about this special circumstances issue?
She's very, very on, Denny. She pegged it right. There are code words, and Vito probably, and you from your experience, probably experienced this. There are code words that law enforcement understands when coming from another law enforcement officer. There's no doubt in my mind that whoever that officer was that called Sergeant McKenzie that night definitely was giving him a message. And it could, my understanding, in California anyway, there are codes that they use, and special circumstances one, where it's a high-profile politician, citizen who has a great deal of influence in the political field, or peace officers, law enforcement agents. So McKayla is very right on when she believes that.
Hey, Vito or Susan, any thoughts?
Yeah, Denny, a couple things. One part you already read about the discharging of the firearm. Number one, there are criminal charges against this. Now, this is Florida, so I don't know how it's worded, but, you know, number one, you got careless and reckless behavior with a gun. That's the waving it around. Number two, you got discharging a firearm. So right there, if anybody witnessed this, okay, I mean, it's in these mounds of paperwork that we all read over the last day or so here. And, I mean, so there's criminal charges there. So people are supposed to be arrested there. Denny, in the next paragraph, right before you, when you stopped, it's showing here that they failed to question witnesses, but they failed to pursue a single lead or to impound the car. Now, the kid was shot in the car. He was in the back seat, leaning forward between the seats, and he was shot in the head. Okay? I mean, these aren't difficult things here, Denny. This is just you impound the car. No car was impounded. And, Gene, one question on my mind after reading all these pages is, It says, within 2 hours of the shooting, they, meaning the police, obtained peroxide from the hospital ER and instructed Rita Nordmack to begin cleaning the blood out of the vehicle. Who obtained that information? How did you find out about that?
Well,
Important, just because it would lead to something if there's credible people that actually saw this and everything.
See, it's uncertain as to how that information was gathered, but there was evidence to support that peroxide was also used to clean a shirt, or the shirt
right. That
was Nordmark's was covered with blood was substituted with another shirt. In answer to your question, Vito, I don't know how the information of peroxide came up.
Was it a police report or something, maybe, or a supplemental report somewhere?
It could have been. All I have is documents from Mikhaila, and I don't have access to the police reports because, like I said, Citizens Against Homicide didn't take the case officially. It was more or less unofficial, and I was going to handle it, you know, kind of a backdoor approach, but I'd have to honestly say I don't know how that subject was broached.
Well, you know,
but in answer to your concern about the weapon, Vito,
yes. You
know, there is a federal law,
mm-hmm.
and that prohibits the carrying of a firearm by an off-duty peace officer when that person is under the influence of alcohol or another intoxicating or hallucinatory drug or substance, and that was enacted by President George W. Bush as part of the national security law. And why Sergeant McKenzie would even say Nordmark did nothing illegal or wrong is beyond me. The guy's, you know, living in another world. If he strongly believes that,
because this is way before the shooting. I mean, you know, if we took it step by step, okay, you got like you just said, an intoxicated officer waving a gun around, his friend shooting the gun off, and this is before this young man is killed. I mean, so if people would have taken action at that time, this kid is still alive. Okay,
but
so you got one thing after the other. The most bizarre thing in all these pages to me as an ex-cop is the not impounding of a car, the crime scene vehicle. You don't impound the car? I mean, that's absolutely amazing.
They allowed her to take it home.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, very unbelievable.
Great crime scene processing, huh, Vito?
Oh, it's absolutely incredible. I mean, you take the car home. I mean, that's, you know, the case is altered right there, Denny. You know that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's all changed around right there. I mean, you know, since we've been doing these things, all of us on this show have worked what we would call bizarre cases, okay? We work them all the time. But what we're doing on CrimeWire is we're highlighting these cases, which unfortunately are all bizarre, and every week they get worse and worse. You know, I mean, we had this Oklahoma stuff. Oklahoma was not okay. We kidded around about that title. Now we got this case. And as I read this, as somebody since 1969 trained in this stuff, I just shake my head. I don't know which way to go. Because it's like going to – now, this is 9 years old already, right? This is 2001.
Yeah.
And nothing's going on. Absolutely nothing.
No. And wait.
But, you know,
but it's also the families. You know, if the families didn't say, I'm not sitting back, because many of them do, there are a lot of these cases we don't even get or hear about because the families don't have the ability or they're bullied into being quiet. And in cases like this, they don't give up. And that's what people have to do. They have to question. They have to ask. Otherwise, we wouldn't be hearing about this one now in 2010.
And Mikhaila has pursued this and vigorously pursued it. And
but Mikhaila, she's also a lawyer, and she's got a legal background, so she knows from what, even though that's not her area of expertise, probably. But she knew, she went to law school. A lot of the people that we work with don't have that opportunity, and she knew, and she didn't give up. And there's hope that that's why she went to law school, for justice. And she's going to make sure her son gets justice.
Well, you know, the irony of this whole thing, Susan, is that this guy, Nordmark, is still working with the Department of Corrections there in Florida, and he should have been prosecuted for the federal law violation, the gun violation, I'm sorry, as well as fired from his job as you know, I'm a veteran of the Department of Corrections here in California, and when you go through the academy, we instill in the officers' mind that you do not carry that weapon out and about when you are drinking, number one.
Oh,
if
please.
You carry it, you don't take it in.
Who doesn't? Who wants to show off? How many of these guys take, and I see this all the time, they're with their girlfriends at a bar, the gun's in the sock or the holster in the, down by the leg, and, hey, baby, you want to see my gun? I mean, come on.
Well, they
go out drinking.
Those are the ones that need to be fired.
Well, but nobody's monitoring them. You know, nobody's saying, here, put your gun someplace. And I've seen people do it through the years. It's ridiculous. And in Florida, I read up on the security guards, you know, what's special exception, but this guy was a correctional officer, so he did have to go through some training.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He goes to the academy.
But somebody should check, too, to see if he's related to someone on the force. Somebody should also check to see, you know, I bet you this guy's got a record of some sort. I bet you he's had police response. Because a guy like this, in my opinion, might have some issues, divorces that have led to violent incidences where the orders of protection could have quite possibly not gone through, or the person didn't get it. Because somebody like this is cocky. They get away with it. And he's continuing to be cocky. So if he got away with this, what else is he getting away with in his capacity every day, you know, with what he does?
Well, he has a history of penal code violations as well as work disciplinaries. And why he's still employed is beyond me. But, you know, Florida Department of Corrections are probably in dire need of correctional officers.
That's a sad statement, and that means that, you know, that they'll take anybody and give him a gun. I mean, he has to have a certification. Maybe Michaela could look and see if the certification of this officer can be, you know, somehow stripped. Maybe that's a way to do this.
Hopefully a U.S. Federal prosecutor might get involved in this if anybody's out there listening. Take a look into this case, and because there's a I don't know. If
obviously, everybody's afraid to get their underwear dirty here, guys, and this is wrong, and it's got to stop.
Hey, Gene.
Yes.
You should. One thing I would suggest is that you or the family can find out this took place in obviously Tarpon Springs, but I would want to find out where the closest Internal Affairs Division unit, and what would cover Tarpon Springs Police.
But Denny, don't do it countywide, but isn't there maybe some state police level, or don't these guys all belong to a union as well that they have to be accountable maybe through a higher place?
Well, you know, the internal affairs are the guys that don't mess around. You know, those are the ones that could care less about who's cousin and this, things like that. I mean, that would be one suggestion. See, the problem we got here, again, 9 years, the car is gone. The bloody or unbloody shirt is gone. I mean, all these things are gone, you know. I mean, the way you catch a guy like this, I mean, one of the ways, there's numerous ways now, 10 years later, but, you know, this is the type of thing where you have a woman cuddle up to him at a bar, you know, get him drunk, and then he makes some statements. I mean, you don't have a lot of choices on this. This is a 10-year-old case with all the evidence gone. See?
Now, let me just bring the listeners up to date on some other bizarre things here. Now, Sean was wedged in the back seat of the car when they arrived at the hospital, and Mr. Nordmark, Dan Nordmark, the corrections officer, actually helped to get him out, and he had Sean's bleeding head basically up against his chest, okay, and he was bleeding profusely. It turns out that supposedly his shirt was going to be marked into evidence and examined. It turns out the shirt was never marked into evidence, and in fact, the lab reported, even though the shirt wasn't marked in, they reported testing it, conflicting statements as to what tests were done. And the shirt was basically clean. No blood was found at all. Now, that seems to be an impossibility. Michaela thinks that the family, that Nordmark's shirt was either treated with peroxide or some other caustic agent to remove all traces of blood stains, or the shirt was simply substituted with a clean shirt.
But and wouldn't the blood have dripped down too to his shoes, Vito, and other places on his, not just the shirt, his maybe his belt?
Of course. I mean, it's you know, we go back to the old accountability thing here, Susan. When people don't have any accountability to anybody, they roam free. And that's what happened here. You got this person taking care of that person, this division of a police department taking care of that. And, I mean, you know, things disappear. I mean, how could, like Denny said, you got a shirt, the man by his own account said, I pulled him out, he was wedged in, I lifted him up, there was blood all over the shirt, and there's, like Denny says, conflicting reports of blood or not blood. I mean, there's no conflicting reports. It must have been a blood-soaked shirt. It's gone. You know, this peroxide in the car, everything else. It's sad. It's basically a very sad commentary on police work when you have a case of that nature, you know.
Yeah. Can I ask two based on a new determination? Go ahead.
There's a Sergeant McKenzie who was in charge of the investigation, and he worked at stealth speed to begin the cover-up, as far as I'm concerned, because immediately he started trying to shut people up. He threatened them with arrest if they spoke to the press, spoke to anybody of significance. And why he would put his career on the line is beyond me, but he did. He said that he had performed some or had some testing done for gunshot residue as well as blood with the luminol, and the forensic specialist, I believe her initial is S. Jacob, said, no, that's wrong. I would have witnessed everything. The luminol testing was never done. Had I personally performed the test, I would have drafted the required forensic report, et cetera. All right. Then, shortly thereafter, the Tarpon Springs police learned that after receiving information indicating that they had fabricated material evidence regarding the most conclusive piece of evidence, she changed her mind and said, oh, now I remember, I did do that test. Well, that's a bunch of baloney. And, you know, there's a lot of people complicit in this cover-up, and it's despicable that the county and city employees would be involved in a cover-up.
Gene, how did the mother get the death certificate changed from suicide to undetermined?
She never did.
Okay. Now,
My understanding is they never did. Now, there was a, I believe, I'd have to check my notes, but I believe there was a politician who said this should be changed to undetermined at best. And
because the medical examiner signed shot self, which you can't do.
Oh, yeah. Here it is. As a Pinellas County State Attorney, Bernie McCabe stated that stated to a former legislator. That's where I got the politician.
Okay, this is all, you know. Also, isn't this an election year? Isn't this an election year for most states around the country? Can we check and see if Florida's an election year, and make some noise?
You know, can I ask a question, Susan?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Peter Hyatt. Has there been any determination at all, because as I'm listening to this, and Vito makes perfect sense about the car not being impounding and some of the actions that were taken, some of the actions that weren't taken, is there any form of a motive surfacing anywhere? Did someone have, that you can sense, a reason to have this brushed under the rug?
What I gathered, Peter, is that Sean's behavior at that one bar with the karaoke lady, he pretty much came, for all intent and purposes, came to her aid and really upset Nordmark and Dilliman, I guess is how you pronounce it. And that's the only motive I could think of. There may be others out there, and I don't know.
So, Gene, you may think that maybe he was, like, you know, just trying to be nice, and they were saying get away from her, and they got angry.
Apparently he defended her. They were basically attacking her verbally out in the parking lot when she was trying to load her equipment. and he intervened on her behalf and said, "What are you bothering this lady for? She didn't do anything wrong." And they apparently resented that. In fact, let me just read real quickly the deposition, the quote from the deposition that the karaoke lady gave to the state attorneys during the investigation. She said that when she had to quit for the night, they followed her, and this Bernie Dillman and Nordmark started calling her names. They called me, I'm not going to say the names, "You effing C-word, you effing whore, we'll beat your ass." Question from the state attorney, and Sean was playing pool. Sean was not involved. Back to the karaoke lady. "When I was loading my equipment, they came up and started screaming at me again. They surrounded my car yelling at me. Sean came out and asked them, 'Why are you yelling at her? She hasn't done anything.' The way they looked at him and their demeanor that night, they were so mean. They were so evil." And the question from the attorney, being mean and looking at somebody is one thing, but it's a pretty big leap to say they killed somebody, too.
Answer, can I ask, was everybody the same? Were they Caucasian? Were they, you know, was there an ethnicity thing here going on as well, or no?
I don't know.
You know, I don't know.
Okay. I mean, that's a, you know.
No. Hey, Susan, what? Basically what you have here, truthfully, I mean, seeing this so many times in my lifetime as a cop and everything, is you have on one end, a lot of times you have the happy drunk, okay? This is the total forest away from that. These are people that not only are mean drunk, they're evil mean, where they, and you know, the poor kid is trying to reason with them. And I've always told people, I've told my own family, if you're involved with a drunk somewhere and they're talking, to not try to reason with them, because you can't say, "Why are you doing this?" or "Why are you doing that?"
That's a good point.
They're totally out of their head, and they're nasty and they're mean, and they looked at this kid as somebody interfering with them, because they built up a hatred towards this DJ or this karaoke girl, and now he was siding with them. So they look at him like, "Oh, I just want to kill this kid," you know, and through their lack of any senses here, you know, and that's basically what went on here. This is about the epitome of how far you could go as far as being a nasty drunk, and that's what you got here. Susan, why don't you tell the listeners the video of Normark's testimony? It's on YouTube or something, where they can actually watch this guy when he's interviewed.
Yeah,
he took the fifth 600 times.
Yeah, 600 times.
Yeah.
Just put in Nordmark on YouTube and you'll get it.
I've got to interject something. My wife just told me that the Nordmark had been fired, and the additional piece of information is that the death certificate was changed.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Because it says, but he still checked the damn box. I mean, who is his medical examiner? Bozo the Clown? I mean, come on. It doesn't add up. And where is this guy's boss to even do this? After a lengthy, you know, she got the death certificate changed from suicide to undetermined. However, in the box, how the injury occurred, the medical examiner, must have been drunk himself, typed in "shot self," negating the change. What the heck is that? Is that a secret code for cover up?
I would think so.
We posted the link also in the chat room to that Nordmark testimony, if anybody would like to check him out. Gene, we're out of time. Thank you very, very much. I appreciate your help.
Okay, last word, Denny. I encourage your listeners to log on to the Sean McMillan Story website at www.copslliesandcoverups.com, and last bit of information is that the Nordmark and Dillman were eventually arrested for handling a gun while intoxicated.
But we need to also check. You know what you guys need to do too, because I've seen this happen, is they get recertified in another state, and happened a lot. My suggestion is somebody needs to keep a little bit of a watchful eye on them to see if they've surfaced in Alabama and Utah, somewhere else, because I see these repeated with police officers who are violent that I work with every day that, you know, get arrested, and then all of a sudden they're somewhere else working in a different state, and they get their certification to start over again to be peace officers.
Did you see, Susan, just in the chat room from McCalla, she's in the chat room, The ME that did the original autopsy was Charles Siebert. He's the same ME that sided with the police. Remember that boot camp case in Florida where the kid was abused and stuff? And they said it was sickle cell initially. Well, this is the same ME.
Yeah.
Okay, Gene, thanks an awful lot. And
thank you, and I hope I did justice for the McMillan family, and thank you, Mikayla, for allowing me to represent your family.
You certainly did.
Gene, I'm
going to
be in touch too, okay?
Okay.
Okay, we're going to move on now to the Joshua Whittier case. It was the morning of February 18, 2007. Melody Schmidt was walking her dog as she did each morning before going about her daily routine. Her cell phone rang. It startled her. It was a new phone, and she had yet to figure out how to turn down the distracting ringer. Melody answered the phone. Melody's hands trembled as she disconnected the call. At the end of the residential driveway, Melody fell to her knees. All mothers have a special place where their children always reside when all is well. When a mother loses a child, it's like a violent surgery from within, without anesthesia. 24 years earlier, almost to the day, Melody gave birth to a beautiful 7-pound boy who she named Joshua. Joshua Whittaker was found dead at 6:30 a.m. on February the 18th in Navarre Beach, Florida. His body was lying face down in the sand at the water's edge near Joanna Pagola's bar. His chin, knees, and wrist were scraped as if he had been dragged there. A pack of cigarettes, which were dry, and a bottle of Corona beer were close by. His wallet that earlier had contained $900 from a newly cashed paycheck stub was found up on the beach. The Santa Rosa County Sheriff's Office refused to investigate further. The case was shut when the ruling in the summary case's notes were officially entered. Death by accidental drowning. They speculate that Josh, who had been drinking heavily, walked out to the end of the pier and fell into the water. If Josh had fallen off the pier, the tide and the fierce winds would have swept his body in the opposite direction from where it was found. The cigarette and the beer bottle would not have been next to him, and there would not have been wounds on those particular areas of his body. The autopsy report makes no mention of any water at all in his lungs. They were totally clear. Joining us on the show is Melody Schmidt. Melody, thank you for being on CrimeWire tonight.
Thank you guys for having me.
As what I read, basically a good synopsis of the background of this a little bit?
Yes, sir.
Okay, where do we stand now, 3.5 years later on this?
Recently, I have, my private investigators, which would be Mike Simler, Lou Schmidt, and Ollie Gray, are working on Josh's case pro bono, have contacted the sheriff of Santa Rosa County. I have contacted the medical examiner, making certain requests, and they're totally ignoring us. They have not even acknowledged that we've contacted them.
Okay.
I just recently contacted the U.S. attorney. Obama put in a new person for the state of Florida or in that general area, so I contacted them asking if they could help. I am waiting to hear back from this individual who called for the new U.S. attorney. Her name is Pamela Marshall, and the person I talked to is a prosecutor. He is going to be contacting FDLE and FBI, which I've already contacted, and they said they couldn't do anything.
Can you turn down your computer, please? Melody?
I don't have a computer on.
Somebody's sound is coming back to us.
Talk about the thunderstorm brewing.
Okay. Talk about the kid that was with him that day, his friend that basically can't look you in the eye and has kind of gone the other way after this happened.
He actually just got out of prison probably about 2 months ago for beating up his pregnant girlfriend, and his stepbrother, I think, is still in prison. I am not sure on that one, for robbing a house and assaulting somebody. I haven't spoken to them recently. I know that the sheriff found out I'm still digging and have them questioned, and we read the questioning, and it's ridiculously stupid. It's so obvious that They're not asking pertinent questions.
Well, it's obvious that he knows more than what he's saying because he was with your son that day. They were out drinking.
Mm-hmm.
That yes. paycheck, where did that not, you know, where did that money go?
Right.
You know, the $900.
It's probably washed away in the water is what they're thinking.
Melody, correct me if I'm wrong here, but isn't that area, I've never been there before, but my impression is from previous conversations that that's what we might refer to as a good old boy situation.
Definitely, yes.
Would you explain
definitely.
A little bit about it and what it's like there, the political aspect of it and all that?
Well, everybody watches everybody's back. They don't go by the law. I think they pick and choose what they want to enforce and when they want to enforce it. Because so-and-so knows so-and-so, and then that so-and-so's brother and the commissioner. Everybody, they pretty much own that town, and it's such a small town. People don't realize how bad it really is until you get in the middle of something like what I'm going through. You just don't have a clue. On the surface, it seems like a nice, quiet, touristic town. And it's not. There's so much going on. Actually, Andrea Minyard, the medical examiner on Josh's case, was put on Siebert, who was removed from the sheriff's beating camp. Minyard had been previously fired from that district for incompetency, and when they removed Siebert, they put Minyard back on there at $50,000 a month temporarily.
Hey, Melody?
Yes, sir.
In the case here that we've read, mm-hmm. obviously they were saying death by accidental drowning. And
mm-hmm.
then you've got this David Craig, who's from Reality News.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me get back to the accidental drowning.
Mm-hmm.
They find a cell phone in your son's pocket that
mm-hmm.
was working perfectly. So now
right.
anybody that's listening to the show knows that how water affects a cell phone. I mean, I was walking in the trying to get out of a pouring rain the other day, and I had my hand over my cell phone to make sure it didn't get wet, so it
mm-hmm.
would get ruined. Now they're saying he accidentally drowned, but yet this cell phone, totally dry and totally working, I mean, is a little bit bizarre. Then, and then later on, or before that, at 3:30 in the morning, a woman and her husband who were delivering newspapers were startled when two men suddenly stepped out from under the tiki-style roof. The
mm-hmm.
couple became nervous, got into their car, and drove off. When David Craig of Reality News showed this woman pictures of Josh's companions that evening, she identified one of the men. She
mm-hmm.
identified one of the men as one of the ones she had seen on the beach. Now,
yes.
I'm sure your PIs, because these are good PIs that you got, I'm sure they've already gone back and talked to David Craig and talked to this woman, right, and gotten statements from her.
As far as the statements, I don't know. I know they have communicated with David Craig. And please forgive me. We have a wicked storm hitting us right now.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Yes, and back to the good old boys, if I could add to that, I have contacted, you name it, I've contacted, I went all the way to the governor, I've contacted DEA, FBI, ACLU, FDLE. Nobody will do anything. I'm only getting excuses. I went to the state attorney when I found out that the person who spent the entire day with my son was best friends with the 24-year-old detective that was originally put on the case. I said, that's a conflict of interest. And she had no experience in doing homicide investigations, so they removed her from the case. She gave me Josh's identification 2 weeks after he died. She said, this is, usually we would keep this for evidence, but we figured you might want it. So I carefully put it in an envelope where it has stayed. Just different things like that. They closed the case prematurely.
Tell us a little bit about the blood.
You know what, Peter Hyatt, what Peter Hyatt's on. Why don't we have him weigh in a little bit?
Go ahead.
Because Peter.
Peter? Peter may have gotten disconnected.
Okay. Because of the ball cap that vanished, the pants on the blood stain, you know, pants
mm-hmm.
that wasn't in the report. I mean, these things are disturbing.
Yes. And the blood stain spatters show that it's from the outside of the pants and it's other people's DNA. We are having other things looked into on that. I recently called FDLE because the sheriff of Santa Rosa County's right-hand man for years just got arrested for 18 counts of molestation of a minor below the age of five. I was pissed. I called FDLE and said, my son was murdered and you won't do anything, but you guys are all over this guy. And so he started looking into the case, but he failed to look at the crime scene pictures.
Did they ever identify the DNA in the pants as to who specifically it was? Was it the guy that was arrested and put in jail that
was
with him that day?
That's one of the things they're ignoring us on.
I'm not sure she was going to do it when I was at America's Most Wanted. No, they had never done anything because they never even admitted there was blood. They just said he got drunk and was hired drunk and fell over the pier in Florida and drowned himself.
Melody,
did they ever identify the DNA in the pants?
Yeah, I was going to say, the two people that you mentioned before, one was arrested for hitting his girlfriend or something?
Uh-huh, yes.
Okay, now, if he was arrested, his DNA would be in the DNA bank. And,
you know, everybody, somebody's computer or something is all coming back on us.
Yeah, I know.
I know, it's weird. I don't have a computer on.
I think it's from the, I think it just was taken care of. We've got a caller on the line here. I don't know if there's a question or comment. Let me check. Caller from 443 area code, you're on. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I just wanted to say hi to Melody. Melody, it's okay. Kim.
Hi, Kim.
Kim McKellar. Oh. Yeah, I had trouble logging on, but I wanted to call in support, and I wondered if any of the participants could comment on what can be done in cases like this where families, everyone obviously, not only the family, but others who know about the case, see that the evidence has not been disclosed or otherwise destroyed. And is there any recourse other than just, as Melody has done, going to local officials and trying to go to state and maybe even federal officials? Do you have any advice for people as far as what can be done about it?
It's funny you mention that, because as it happens, this coming Sunday night, we're doing our first Crime Wire special on Blog Talk, and we're going to spend an entire hour strictly on this medical examiner, coroner-type issues. And we're going to talk to people who have made progress in that area, of course, every jurisdiction is different, so there isn't a one-size-fits-all. But we're going to be discussing that for a full hour this Sunday night. And if you have the opportunity to listen in, please do. And you can call in with questions and comments. So
and also to the caller, Melody's fortunate on a case like this where she has three very good PIs working the case for her. Okay, now what happens with that is that as they obtain any evidence on a case of this nature, they're representing her, they're representing the family, the police department, the medical examiner, the word is out there. Everybody knows that these people are digging. So a lot of times that's when the other side throws up their hand a little bit and hopefully says, let's take another look at this, a little more in-depth look at this whole situation. That's what we have to hope for on this. Have you felt, Melody, that the PIs have obtained, or have they done a pretty good job for you on this?
Absolutely. They've been nothing but kind and very thorough, and they don't get in my way if I have a suggestion. They say, Melody, do what you want. You, of course, do what you need to do.
And I just checked online as well, and, you know, this is an election year. I just checked for the state of Florida. They're all running for office. You know, this is the perfect time to hold their panties to the fire, because that's what they wear, panties, when they don't do their job.
Melody, let me ask you this. Now, I know that you've been, you know, fighting this thing and going up and down the ladder and the chain of command and all that kind of thing. Has anybody explained to you where their theory on this $900 disappeared? They think it washed out to sea? Is that what they're trying to say?
Oh, they don't even know. They haven't answered that. I mean, we believe it was stolen by the people who lost Josh that night. Yeah. But no, it just conveniently washed away in the ocean, you know. And the people who found Josh, one of them was a pastor, and I spoke to him right after all of this happened, and he said, Melody, your son wasn't in the water, and he hadn't been in the water. His clothes didn't look wet to me at all.
You know, you hit a good word there, I think, in some cases, and that is convenient. And we are not a police-bashing program. We're pro-law enforcement. However, when there are screw-ups, we're also interested in exposing those. And I think in some cases, when an investigation isn't done properly, maybe it was incompetence, maybe it was laziness, maybe it was corruption, whatever the reason, a lot of times I think scenarios are created that are convenient to the authorities for why they didn't do certain things. And
sure,
if they can explain away this missing $900 by, you know, alleging that, oh, yeah, the tide must have caught it.
Explain why the pants weren't tested and the people around him that night weren't tested with their DNA. Explain how their DNA got on his damn pants.
That's never been answered. You're exactly right. And you know, and Kim, the caller, too, had a question about how do you deal with these things.
I was just going to comment that I think that's true because the police have pressure to close the case. So any convenient theory that they can sit around and come up with to close the case, never mind that, you know, all the facts don't fit together. They weren't counting on Melody digging, you know, for years and years and finding all this other evidence out and reexamining and hiring somebody to go over and comb through. And, you know, of course, I mean, the scary thing is to think of how many times this actually happens, and it's a reality because of, like you said, a lot of reasons, you know, time factors and negligence.
Even 1%, even when this happens 1% of the time, that's so many hundreds of cases across the country. Even at 1%, let's say the police 99% of the job time did an excellent job. 1% is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases that are bad. I said once before on a show several months ago in Connecticut, a fire chief's son was involved in an accident. Before the police got to the scene, the fire chief had his firemen go to the son's car and clear out all the beer cans and the bottles and everything else. This was documented by witnesses that watched from their stoops of their stairs and everything else. So these things do happen. By the time the police came, all the beer cans and all that stuff was out of the kid's car. So these things happen. These things happen across the country. And the only way you do it is, I hate to keep saying it, you got to keep making noise about it.
You do. And, you can't quit. You cannot stay stuck in your grieving. And I think that's how come we keep going. It's for the love of our kids. And a mother's heart is you don't want to see this somebody happen to somebody else. That's the biggest reason why we keep doing this. And can I add on real quick? The autopsy, we're finding some more information that was not done, and we're trying to find out if it was legally overlooked, that it was legally supposed to be done, and it's going to be huge on this case if we find out it should have been done. She's playing games with how she handled things. We also have a person has contacted me recently. An attorney has a client. I guess something similar happened to him 20 years ago, and he's ready to put up a $5,000 reward for anybody that will come forward with information on Josh's case. We are getting all our ducks in a row on that, how to handle that, and who to contact with information.
Mm-hmm.
But just people helping, just like you guys. I told Denny the other day, we keep paddling, but you guys keep helping the boat moving because we have to stop and we get emotional and we grieve, and sometimes you just have to set it down. But you guys keep us going. Thank you.
Well, the word has gotten back to us. This word is getting around the country that we do this show. And the people, see, and people that are honest and law-abiding, they don't care, okay, because you have nothing to hide. I was an honest cop. I didn't care how hard my bosses were or whatever because I didn't have anything to hide. But some of the people around me that were corrupt, of course, you have something to hide, and you worry about shows of this nature that come out and talk about these things because they would rather let it lie. Look at the last case we talked about in the first half hour. 9 years old already. 9 years old with all the evidence gone. Here, at least, this case is a little bit different. It's only 3 years old, which I'm not downplaying the amount of time, but you do have three PIs working on it, and hopefully some things will be there. But everybody's got to make noise. We got people on here. Oh, there's a lot of great crime shows on Blog Talk Radio. We're happy to be one of them to continue to just pound away and pound away at these things.
Vito, let me address the one thing, and perhaps this Melody can answer this, but and see if you agree from your law enforcement experience. When you start trying to get other agencies of jurisdiction, first of all, that some of them will say that they don't have jurisdiction. For example, the feds might say, well, that's a local case. You know, we really have, although the feds can be pretty creative, and if they really want to get in something bad enough, they can usually find a hook. But I know, for example, you had a sheriff's department handling the investigation. Then you're not satisfied, so you go to the state police or in Florida, FDLE, whatever it is. Now, it was my experience that other agency, even though they have jurisdiction statewide, politically, they're not enthused about sticking their nose in to basically, well, in some respects, they're investigating the other agency for incompetency. I mean, they're going to take a second look at the same evidence. And
right.
A lot of them will resist. I don't know if that's been your experience, but from a political perspective, it's not all that easy to get another agency to intervene and take over a case from or take a second look at without being invited. They love it if the other agency invites them in. Oh, hey, we need a hand with this. Can you help us out? That's great.
Right.
But if the other agency is claiming they've got it all wrapped up, and you know, what do you mean the state's coming in now? And look, it can be a political hot potato.
You're totally right, Denny. Not only political, but also a pride issue. If I'm the chief, if I'm the chief of this town where the incident took place, and you're the chief of a bigger city, a little distance from me, and we know each other, and you offer your assistance to me. Okay, you say, hey, look, you know, we got some guys free. They do a lot of these cases in the course of the year, Vito. You want me to send three guys down there for a couple of months? Now, a good cop, somebody that doesn't care who solves. See, the whole bottom line is you're supposed to not care who solves the case as long as the case is solved. That's in a perfect world, that's how it's supposed to be. But now I say to you, hey, Chief Griffith, look, we're capable here, all right? We haven't solved it yet, but we don't really need your assistance. Thank you. Goodbye. That's what happens more times than not on these cases, okay? So, you know, not only political, but also that whole pride thing, because you're supposed to be able, I'm supposed to be able to throw up my hands and say, hey, Denny, look, man, this is out of our league here. We really need your help, man. Can you help us out with this? That's how it's supposed to go, Denny, you see? And
absolutely.
A lot of times it don't, you know?
Like you say, the perfect world, that's the way it would be.
That's right.
Melody?
Yes.
Melody?
Yes.
It's Kim again. Did you share with any of the listeners about what happened with America's Most Wanted?
No, I was just about to. You know how I
go
met
ahead.
Kim was Santa Rosa County had, Navarre Press had a news article on the front page of one of their deputies was up for a rewards program with America's Most Wanted. And this is right after Josh died a couple months. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. So I called and I got put in touch with Kim because Kim was handling the story. I said, you need to understand how corrupt this place is. And she said, what? And I started telling her stories of all the things I had started learning. And she says, I'm going to help you, Melody, however I can. I'm going to help you. And we have become friends, and I've known her for 3 years now. And since then, within a couple of months, Kim called the sheriff of Santa Rosa County, Sheriff Wendell Hall. And a couple months later, Kim had lost her job.
I was collecting material Melody had sent to the show, and I passed it on to the proper producer. You know, I asked through the channels where it should go, and there was a certain reporter assigned to that state. And it probably wasn't even 2 months, Melody, because it was right before Memorial Day, I remember, and I think we met in April. But anyway, I was called by Human Resources and told point blank that I was told not to touch that story. So that's the kind of sometimes, I don't want to, you know, make it sound like it happens all the time, but that's the kind of protection that these guys get sometimes when they've already closed the case and they don't want somebody digging in for whatever reason, be it that one of the perpetrators has a relative on the local force there or whatever. You know?
Well,
yeah.
Kim, we're not going to go away, all of us, you know.
Yeah.
We're here. We're here for you, Melody. We need to wrap it up. We have about 40 seconds over here, but we are here. We will keep doing this, okay?
And
we want to thank you tonight. Denny, you take us out on this a little
bit? Thank you very much, Melody, and thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, and keep listening.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Thanks
okay,
for
I just
your wanted, work.
You're welcome. I just want to say real quick, we're going to be doing our special Sunday night, this coming Sunday, the 25th, 9 o'clock Eastern, and we're going to do a 90-minute. I thought it was an hour. It's going to be 90 minutes from 9 till 10:30 about the ME issue and corner issue. So thank you very much to our Crime Wire team, research producer Kim Colton, public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show, our next regularly scheduled show, will be next Tuesday, July 27th. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Well, remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. Good night and God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. God bless you guys.
Good night.